Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you everyone for being here with us again this Sunday as we're going to talk about some interesting current events. Harriet Kaur with us today, Executive Director, Charlottesville Office of the International Rescue Committee. Harriet, welcome back.
Hi, Rick. It's good to be back.
I appreciate you coming in anytime and all the time. So the International Rescue Committee, for those of you who aren't aware, give us a little background on the fact that Charlottesville has its own office.
It's always, people are like, why is IRC here? But so I can just tell you a little bit about our organization, but we're an international humanitarian aid organization. And we operate about over 40 countries around the world. But in the U.S., our work is focused around refugee resettlement. So Charlottesville is one of about 25 offices across the country that IRC has. It's really funny, but it's like really Charlottesville has pretty much everything it takes to be a really great site to resettle refugees. We've got good healthcare, good schools, a safe community, a welcoming community. It's been a really great place. We've been here for, 1998. So this is our 23rd year now. And in that time, we've resettled over 4,500 refugees in Charlottesville.
That's pretty impressive. You said that the IRC has 25 offices in the United States, and with Charlottesville being one of them. But you've been on the program a handful of times in the past as different current events have brought the IRC to light. Charlottesville is not the 25th office. I mean, Charlottesville was actually one of the first number of offices, correct?
Well, maybe not quite that way, because there were some offices that actually opened in like the 70s with the, you know, kind of the Indo-Chinese, Vietnamese refugees who were coming in. And that was kind of the start of refugee resettlement in this country as we know it. So there's a few of those offices that really started in like the mid to late 70s, early 80s, but we're not the newest either. So we've definitely been around. We've made our mark. We're known. And now we've, from our Charlottesville office, we actually have opened a second office in Richmond. But I always tell people in Charlottesville that Richmond operates as a sub office of Charlottesville and not the other way around. So, because we were here first.
Pretty nice. I'm sure that it's nice to be able to tell it that way for a change. So again, Harriet Kaur with us today, Executive Director of the Charlottesville Office of the International Rescue Committee. So Harriet, the IRC, as we focus on refugee resettlement and the work that's being done, did the IRC have a specific agenda or a hopeful plan for the Biden and Harris administration as they were taking office?
Well, I think IRC, as one of the 9 national resettlement networks. But I think we're one of the leaders kind of on the advocacy and public policy side. There was great interest. Candidate Biden, when Vice President Biden, when he was in his campaign, did make these pledges that we wanted to hear, which was to rebuild the refugee resettlement program, which had been, had a difficult time during the previous administration. And he made the commitment that we were looking for, which was to set a a goal, an emissions goal of 125,000 refugees a year. I'd say during the end of the Obama administration, you know, we were probably bringing in about 85,000 refugees a year. And if you cast your memory back, President Obama in the fall of 2016 had committed that to raise that number to 110,000 so we could bring in Syrian refugees and really work with that population. And then that all got, you know, swept aside in a lot of the other anti-immigrant actions that happened over the following years. So 125,000 was the number that we had all been lobbying for and hoping for. So he had that in his campaign. That did not happen last year, after the inauguration, but we believe that he will sign for that number of people to enter. You know, who knows if that many will really make it, but the president setting a goal that's ambitious and that recognizes the huge need of displaced people around the world just means a lot to us. It's a sign that America's back, you know, and at the head of countries that you really want to help and recognize the plight of people who've been forcibly displaced and can't go home.
So you make mention that there's belief at the IRC that the Biden and Harris administration will sign for 125,000 refugees. Yeah. Is that belief or hope?
So he hasn't signed. So there's the president each year has to sign a presidential determination. That's the way it's set up. It hasn't been signed yet, but all indications are that that's what will happen. Yeah.
There have been a lot of campaign promises made by a lot of candidates that have become president that haven't all been met.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was an expectation that he would do that immediately upon taking office, like after January, that he would raise the level up. And that didn't happen. I don't know. I don't remember the exact sequence of events, but that did not happen. And he had really kept these incredibly low Trump era numbers. And it wasn't one of his immediate actions that he took after becoming president. And I don't know if you remember, but there was at some point, finally, like, patience wore out and the refugee advocates just really started making a lot of noise. And he did it finally, like, raise the number of people who could come in during the year that ends today. Well, it's not today, but at the end of September, but half of that, like 62,500. We never were able to do that with COVID and all the other limitations, but that was kind of a step in the right direction. And so I believe he kind of learned his lesson maybe a little bit, but and we'll do the right thing, but we'll see.
So as you talk about this planned increase, mm-hmm. in accepting refugees for coming years and how the IRC has belief that the number will be on track for up to 125,000, how is the IRC and other agencies planning to accommodate that?
So during the previous administration, the capacity of resettlement agencies was weakened. It was reduced. I think something like a third of resettlement sites across the country were closed over that time. So we're in a we're in definitely in a kind of a build back mode. IRC, we did not close any of our offices, or maybe not more than one. So we were very fortunate. We weren't, we were able to maintain better than some of our sister agencies, but a couple of things have happened. One is obviously there's a lot of work being done to reopen sites that had previously been open, or to open new offices and bring more locations into the network. We also started hiring. We got a little bit of, some advanced funds to prepare. So, for example, we've been hiring some new staff and trying to get people trained up so that we can increase the number of people we serve in the coming year and moving forward. So there is this real just a lot of work across the country being done to rebuild the capacity of this network. So that we can do that. And it sounds like, 125,000, it's a big number, but we're a big country. I mean, there's that, it's not like any one city is getting thousands and thousands of people necessarily. It's a lot of small cities, large cities, but also small cities like Charlottesville and all across, almost not all, but almost all the 50 states. So, if we spread people out, we have a lot of room in this country to find people homes and help them rebuild their lives.
Harriet Kaur with us today from the International Rescue Committee. And Harriet is the executive director of the Charlottesville office. We're going to be talking about Afghanistan as we go through the hour. But Harriet, talk a little bit about the IRC and how it came into being. I always found this to be a fascinating tale.
So we date back to 1933. We've been around a long time, but IRC was originally founded at the request of Albert Einstein to try and bring people out of Europe before the Second World War, and so there were a lot of different groups that were operating, but IRC kind of came about with, there were kind of a couple different groups. Two of them merged. That's how we became the International Rescue Committee. But we definitely date back to then. We operated then. And then, another period, IRC also did a lot of work bringing people out of Hungary after, in the 50s, with those political difficulties. And so there's, just a long history of being there at these times of major displacement all the way, back. So we're like 80 something years now. So, and we're still here.
Again, Harriet Kaur with us. So let's talk about Afghanistan. We've now had the evacuation earlier in the year. Did having a predetermined removal date help the IRC with planning on refugee resettlement?
So what you have to remember is that basically everything from our side that's happened is an unplanned emergency. Nothing was planned. It was, we had been issuing like kind of these SIV visas. There was, I don't think there was really any kind of a plan at all to bring out larger numbers of people. We had the SIVs, who were the people who'd worked for the American military or American mission. And those people have been coming out of Afghanistan for years now. We've resettled quite a lot of them in Charlottesville and actually all across Virginia. There's a lot of them. But there was no no plan at all made for a larger evacuation. So we ended up with a very large number of people in very desperate circumstances, basically arriving on our doorstep. I think the vast majority of them are people with a pre-existing relationship with the U.S. They worked with the U.S. They worked for an American-based nonprofit organization. They're journalists who had worked with American or Western journalists. I mean, they're known people. It's not random Afghans, but there was no plan to bring those people out, and they didn't plan to come out. The people that kind of landed here really did truly arrive with the shirts on their back. There was no ramp up time and packing your bags or anything. They just took off. So the whole operation that's happening here in this country, it's monumental. It's kind of being created on the spot, because the entire refugee resettlement system as we know it is actually set up not to do what's being done now. It was set up to hold, usually when there's a civic crisis or a civil war, people flee into neighboring countries. They usually flee into other countries that they can kind of walk into or get to easily. And then the whole system is to hold them there, usually often for very long periods of time, because we know that the average time that someone's in displacement before they ever get to come to a country like the U.S. is 17 years. That's the average time. Usually are there for a very long time. And then eventually they will make their way to the U.S. And that's, we call it planned departure, orderly departure, something like that, that they, all their checks and their everything, all their verifications and their interview, all the stuff we need to know to make sure they are who they say they are and that they're eligible to come. All that stuff is supposed to happen outside the U.S. And when they get on a plane to come, they are all checked out and ready to go. We now have all these people that we had to bring here very urgently for safety. They are out on military bases and installations across the country, and they're now going through that process. Well, we know how to do that process, but we've never been set up to do it here. So it's just like, it is absolutely a massive emergency operation that's being mounted with, and of course, you know, and I think at first there was that first group that came out that we were initially involved, because it's in Virginia with Fort Lee, south of Richmond. And that was just intended, like it was supposed to be like a 2-week operation to bring out the SIVs. They were the people that were very close to having their visas granted, and they just needed the last few things done. And they were kind of brought out to Fort Lee, and then all of a sudden all the rest of it happened, the rest of the evacuation. So it's been a really interesting couple of months, and IRC's been absolutely at the center of it, because we've been very instrumental in setting up the operations on all these military bases. We have staff everywhere trying to get those systems in place.
So what do you do? I mean, when you go to a military base, can you walk me through the process of something that, and granted, we need to take a break here. Actually, let's do that first. But what I want to know is, when we come back from the break, if something normally takes 17 years, how do you do this in weeks or months once somebody's on a military base? But let's take a break and come back, and I'll turn that over to you. Be right back. Welcome back here. Sunday morning wake-up call. International Rescue Committee. Harriet Kaur, Executive Director at the Charlottesville office, as we're talking about refugee resettlement, amongst other things, and Afghanistan. So, Harriet, again, if the IRC is helping with all these refugees on a military base, where, as we know, the military wants to be in control, how is this working?
You know, I have not been, so I have to tell you, I'm not fully up on this, and also like you don't actually discuss what happens on a military base a whole lot, but we've had staff from both our Charlotte and Richmond offices deployed to some of the sites. But I think it is like there's people there from a lot of different government agencies. There's obviously Department of Defense is there, and health people with health issue, you know, health and immigration services, and then the resettlement agencies. But my understanding is we're basically trying to, there is still a set process, because we always say that refugees are the most thoroughly vetted immigrants to come to this country. They go through so many checks and so many steps. So what's happening is all those steps are being recreated in that venue. So it would be like they're doing like interviews with the Department of Homeland Security staff. They're having to do health checks, a lot of security checks. They go through all kinds of security screenings, interviews, multiple interviews with their story and explaining, then trying to figure out, do they have relatives here they want to resettle with, or where they want to go? And it's just this long process. And so they're actually being held on these sites for weeks, for a pretty long period of time. Like I think it's varying according to where they were in the process, but this is taking like, you know, weeks and months to get people along, because we need to make sure that we're not shortcutting the process. We're just doing it here instead of there. So a lot of care is being taken. And it's also, you know, we talk about them as Afghan refugees, but it's also important to note that they have not entered this country with refugee status, which is a special immigration category that's granted only in certain circumstances. So they're entering with an interim status. It's a parole status, humanitarian parole. So there's a lot of, kind of considerations that have to be made around that. Like, how will we work with them moving forward? Cause they're refugees like in name, but not legally, if that makes sense.
So, and you mentioned this a little bit, so this, I'm not asking this part again, but you said that some of these individuals are a little further along than others in the process, just because of, I guess, how they were when they arrived, correct?
Well, so there were people who had in process, like cases at the embassy in Kabul. Like there were people who were already in the process of getting these special immigrant visas. And then there, I think there were other people who maybe, they got married. So they were getting fiance visas. So there were people that they didn't have their visas granted, but they had open cases with documents. And I think all that stuff was kind of, they took it with it. Like that was sort of transferred out somehow out of the embassy.
So if you were 10% along in Afghanistan, or 75% along in Afghanistan, you got to pick that up and move that with you. You didn't have to start fresh.
Theoretically, at least. And the first people who came out were probably like 85 or 90% along. So like the first people came out and were at Fort Lee, they were only there for 3, 4, 5 days. They just had to have the last things finished. But the people now, maybe they're a little bit along, but some of them are, they're just starting their paperwork when they get here. But there was some, not full, but some, I think, attempt to document their eligibility for another status. But, like I said, they weren't, I always kind of worry because like a lot of the news pictures just sort of made it look like just random people were crawling onto the planes, but there was, and I won't swear that that didn't happen, at, you know, once or twice, but there was pretty good security around the airport. Like even people who should have gotten through didn't get through. So they were trying very hard to make sure that the people who got through onto those evacuation flights had some legitimate claim to be on them.
So tell me, was that last sentence or two, did that answer this question then, which was, are some individuals processed differently than others? Because that's what I was curious about. Would somebody who wanted to come along for this reason be processed noticeably differently than someone who was coming along for this reason?
That's a good question. I think that the, you know, Homeland Security, and then, you know, part of Homeland Security is the Immigration and Naturalization Service. They will interview and adjudicate each case based on its merits. And so I think there's, you know, and but the question is like, what happens next? I mean, the people coming to us now, like, these evacuee cases, they're on a, their parolee status does not give them access to the same kind of benefits and rights and things that refugees have or that other kinds of immigrants have. And so one of the things that has to be sorted out, or hopefully will be sorted out, maybe it doesn't have to be, is how do we kind of process them, you know, after this, you know, right now they're here and they're being given kind of legal presence for like 2 years, but there has to be like, what's the next step for them? And so I know that there, Congress is, you know, there's proposed legislation to try and figure that out. One pathway would be to kind of, they can't actually, they may not necessarily be refugees, but to give them access to the full refugee resettlement network and all the benefits and the kind of rights that provides. But, you know, or is there some alternate process? Do they apply for asylum and then have each of their cases individually heard based on its merits? There's, you know, there's a lot of questions out there about what's the next steps for them. But the key thing right now is that they were brought to safety, right? I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot that we can sort all this out, but the immediate thing is, you know, this is a group of people that were in danger for their lives, and that, you know, through their relationship with our country, we have, you know, allowed them to come here. We brought, you know, helped them to come here, and for now they are safe and they have a chance to find a way to build new lives in the U.S. And we're really grateful for that.
And a lot of that has to do with the International Rescue Committee. Harriet Kaur with us today. She's the executive director of the Charlottesville office. Harriet, did the IRC participate or in any way partake in the removal of any of the refugees or parolees in the after August 31st? Those private issues that were non-military?
No. I think those were mounted, you know, kind of organized by private interests. So we have a presence in Afghanistan, but we're a humanitarian aid organization helping, you know, the Afghan people. Like we have offices in different parts of the country, but we didn't participate. We in no way were involved with the actual evacuation or any of that. We have our programs in Afghanistan are focused on helping Afghan people there.
Let's bring it a little closer to home. How does the IRC or the Charlottesville office determine the number of individuals and families for each IRC city, including Charlottesville?
Oh, that's a good question. So it's kind of a back and forth process where we kind of Charlottesville, we can provide, our office can provide input in what we think is appropriate, but there's also kind of a sense of doing your fair share. And kind of what the capacity of the community is. So, obviously a larger city should have a larger capacity. But it is kind of it's a back and forth process. But right now with these Afghan evacuees, everyone is being asked to do much more than we ever thought we could. So just because it's so many people who need to be accommodated in a short period of time. We might have a target number where we're going to resettle we want to resettle 250 people in Charlottesville over the course of the year. We're looking right now at resettling in Charlottesville an equal number on top. So instead of 250, maybe we're going to resettle twice that many this year, and the Afghans may come over a period of 3 to 6 months. So it's going to be very concentrated. So we are very much stretching our capacity in a way that may not always be comfortable, but which we know is critical and needs to be done.
So I make sure I understood that properly. So the original expectation was 250 of all ethnicities and
refugees,
refugees.
Yeah, specifically
for the year.
For the year, I think we were going to try for 275 this year, but that's a number we have done before, and that we.
But that was pre-Afghani situation, it's expected to be 500.
So it's two different programs. So the Afghans are being resettled. It's actually under that's more like technical, but it's a separate program because they're technically not refugees. We have a parallel program for them. So we're still planning to resettle 250 refugees from all different countries. Year being through September 2022. But so we are still expecting refugees from all different countries to come. But in addition, we're doing, we're participating to our maximum capacity to get these Afghans, safely resettled here. So it's like a once in a generation, but it's a one large stretch operation. So we're really getting creative and trying to find new ways to make that happen. And I will say that the community here has been amazing, and we've just really had so much support and people wanting to know how they can help. So we're, right now we're really focused on finding groups to sponsor families and to, as a way to allow us to do that, to make this very fast stretch of capacity. So we're, inviting faith communities, civic groups, PTOs, neighborhood associations, service clubs, even just a group of neighbors, but different groups of people who might be willing to sort of take, help kind of adopt a family, help them find a place to live, furnish an apartment or home for them. And then be volunteers that help them through those first 6 months or so. And we're also kind of trying to expand and see if we can make contacts in whereas usually we try and keep people real close to us in Charlottesville, but expanding into some of our neighboring communities, we're trying to work on contacts, like in Waynesboro or in Lynchburg or Amherst or surrounding cities as well to help us make that happen. So we may find people like communities taking in some of our Afghan refugees who may never have thought that they would be involved in that.
How do you find a home or an apartment in the Charlottesville Albemarle area? And I realize you just mentioned that you're going to expand, but I would think that jobs go with that. With the cost of living in this area,
affordable housing is the greatest challenge. It did not used to be horrendously difficult, but it is right now. And it's not like we're not special, right? We're just part of the pain that so many people in Charlottesville are feeling. But it is very, very challenging. And really for many, many years, even before it became as difficult as it is now, you know, it was when I first started doing resettlement work, more than 15 years ago, we used to hope, if there was one adult in a family that got a decent job, they could at least pay the rent. And now it is basically not possible for a single adult to support a family. It usually takes at least two incomes in a family to even just make rent payments. And that's rent being like well over half your income, like 60% of your income, or, you know, basically eating up almost all your take home pay. So it is really, really challenging. And like I said, not just for refugees, but we're definitely in the mix.
I want to stay on this track for a bit about cost of living and jobs and income. But let's take our second break, talking with Harriet Kaur from the International Rescue Committee, currently discussing the Afghani refugees and resettlement that will be happening in the Charlottesville area. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening with Sunday Morning Wake Up Call today. So Harriet Kaur with us. We're talking about the cost of living in this area and the fact that both adults in almost every case need to have a job. What kind of job are we talking about? Because do many or most or all of the refugees who are being resettled speak English? I've learned from interviews with you in the past that many of them are highly skilled, much more highly skilled than the jobs they often end up taking. So tell me more about how this comes out to play.
You know, we get people with all levels of education, all level of skill. Obviously some speak English, some don't. With this group of Afghans, I think we'll see as they start coming. I think we probably will have a high level of at least one adult in a family speak English, because so many of them were working with American organizations. There's a lot of jobs right now. It's actually, we've been having people call in, and even from far afield, and manufacturing. I think because of COVID, it's actually a really great time to be a job seeker right now. And wages are kind of starting to come up accordingly, but it is really tough. And, you know, I think we've talked about this before. I always say, like, when the bombs start dropping, like, everybody runs. It doesn't matter if you you know, you had like a third grade education or you're a PhD, like everybody's got to go. And so we work with people at all different education levels, and and we acknowledge that we tend to push on people when they first get here to just, you know, you just need to take a job because they really need to become economically self-sufficient through employment as quickly as possible after arrival. It's, you know, we can't say to somebody like, go ahead and like take 6 to 9 months and let's see what we can find you. Like you really need to go to work. But then what we also say is we will stand by you, like get that first job, get an American work history down and then come back to us and we will help you get, you know, work your way back up to your former profession. But there's actually a lot of discussion about this because the governor has actually launched a kind of a task force to look into how we can better work with skilled immigrants that are in Virginia and you know, take advantage of what they bring in. And that's an interesting area. But jobs are not the problem. Housing is really the problem. And a lot of times it might be both adults and family, or, you know, we'll also, maybe we find that like the primary wage earner will have one job and maybe a second part-time job. Some families come and there's an adult child, like there's a, you know, a child in the family who's 18, 19, 20, who might also be able to work. And so we just try to work with each family to come up with a plan to patch it together as best they can.
How about the kids who were going to join the public school system?
Yeah.
What's the challenge, if any, there?
I would say here in Charlottesville, like our both Albemarle County and Charlottesville have really terrific systems set up. They, you know, the kids, if they, you know, depending on their language skills, or they're able to come in through a special, you know, English language program where they're tested and they kind of spend some of their time in a mainstream classroom, but they also spend time in an environment where they're really just learning English and bring up their English skills, so that they can interact with other kids. And it's, I think done in a very, nurturing and child, you know, student centered environment. And the kids, depending how old they are, I think kids tend to thrive, especially the younger kids. I think it's harder for teenagers. And teenagers who maybe by coming, they're also separated from their friends and their social groups. And that can be really hard at that age, but our schools do a really terrific job. They really are. And, really value the diversity of having kids from a lot of different countries and allowing the American born students to learn about different parts of the world. And,
Does IRC provide or assist with any sort of counseling, mental counseling, family counseling? Because I would think the thing that brought this to my mind was you mentioned how well the schools do for the kids, and that's great to hear. And I know that Albemarle County has a lot of second language programs, but I can't imagine that every school would have someone in it that speaks Dari.
Mm-hmm.
On the off chance, assuming that wherever an Afghani refugee gets resettled, that they're going to the school in their neighborhood.
Well, the thing is that the kids are not necessarily spread out across all the schools, because this is like an interesting thing, but the way multi-family housing is located, the the kind of apartments and the kind of places that we tend to use, they tend to be focused into certain specific schools. So you'll find kind of a lot of times the international student population is focused in a few schools, not across all of them, which is interesting. But I will also tell you, though, like it was interesting. I didn't know this myself, and I ran the numbers right when we first started working with this group of Afghans. And I had mentioned earlier in the show that in the 23 years IRC's been in Charlottesville, we've resettled like it's more than 4,500 people. And out of those, 1,400 are Afghans. So more than a quarter of the people that have ever been resettled in Charlottesville are Afghan. We actually have a really significant Afghan population. So
they have a comfortable,
they've got a comfortable
community to come to.
Yep. It's really interesting. It's kind of one of those mysteries, but I think we've resettled Afghan refugees since very early days in the office. And then, you know, also what's interesting is during the last, you know, the previous administration, when with the so-called Muslim ban and all that, when people were closed off from so many countries, Afghanistan was never on that list. Afghans were always able to freely come. They've been one of the populations that could come here. So that they were kind of continuing when to arrive when so many others couldn't. So I think we're pretty good. And we, you know, we've got, we just opened our second now. We have two Afghan grocery stores in Charlottesville. I think it's a comfortable landing pad for people.
Tell me the story. You can, by the way, for listeners, you can go to the IRC website, which is which is going to surprise you. It's rescue.org. some other foundation with I and an R and a C in it swiped the more obvious, but it's rescue.org. And there's a story there about Chef Nouri.
Chef Nouri, yeah.
In Richmond. Will you tell that story for the listeners?
So Chef Nouri, he was actually one of the first, an early family that we resettled when we first opened our office in Richmond. But his an interesting story because I think he kind of grew up as a son of a widowed mother in Afghanistan, very poor family. You know, one of those kids who had to go out and earn money from a very young age to support his mother and his younger siblings, you know, through he has some really harrowing stories of sad jobs he went through, but through a series of things, finally ended up getting a job at the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul. Whatever he was doing, worked his way up into a kitchen job, like washing dishes, and, you know, worked his way up then to chopping vegetables, whatever, worked his way up over a period of years into, you know, a senior chef. And then did come to the U.S. on a special immigrant visa and kind of had to start all over again here, chopping vegetables at a grocery store. We finally, our staff got him, then moved him up and got him a job at a restaurant. And then through that, he now has his own restaurant in Richmond, kind of on the edge of Kerrytown, called The Mantu, M-A-N-T-U, which is a lovely kind of fine dining restaurant. And he is a wonderful man. He provides free welcome meals to our Afghan families so they can have a known comfortable food when they first arrive. And just has been really terrific about giving back the opportunities that were given to him. It's a great story. And if you get a chance to go to the website and look at the video, I think you'll really enjoy it.
Again, that's rescue.org. If you want to look more directly at the Charlottesville office, it's rescue.org/ look for the United States / Charlottesville.
Yeah.
And find your way down. So, Harriet, let's talk a little bit more. You've mentioned needing help from the communities and some groups getting together. So, let's just be blunt and specific about that. What are ways that people who are listening can volunteer? How can they provide needed items for refugees, and what are those items?
So right now, the community has been so generous and has brought us so many donations of diapers and toiletries and so much stuff. We actually have a hold on that right now because we don't have any more room in our office to take it in. We are taking gift cards to like grocery stores or things like that. That's great. Financial donations are always welcome because we can use those to pay for rent and utilities and really important things. And volunteers as well. So people can go to rescue.org/Charlottesville. We have a lot of information up there. And if you're interested in or know of a group that might be interested in sponsoring a family, whether in Charlottesville or in some of the surrounding areas, we would be very interested in hearing from you. And we've actually set up a special email address. It's sponsor.va@rescue.org. And if you just send an email to that address, you'll get a bounce back message that has links for more information. And so we're real interested in hearing from people who might be interested in doing that.
You mentioned donations for utilities. Is something like Dominion and their required down payment, is that an issue every time?
So we have from the government funding, we get a kind of a flat amount of government funding per person. We are able to, like, if we secure housing, like pay a down payment and pay the deposits or whatever's required for people, we can get them started that much. But usually the amount we're given in Charlottesville would often barely, depending on the size of the family, may only last 1 month. We can spend it up to 3 months, but people usually need assistance to keep going before they're really earning enough money to pay all their expenses themselves. That takes longer, probably takes a lot closer to 6 months to get to that point. So we use the private donations we have to keep helping them.
You mentioned government funding. What sort of assistance and or negative feedback are you getting from senators and representatives at the state, federal level?
I'm not saying that there isn't. I know there is. I've read some stuff online, but here, what I'm hearing in Charlottesville, very little.
You have to go to, does the IRC have to go to the federal level on a regular basis and say, don't cut our funding, please increase our funding, and have someone sit in front of the Senate budget committee and listen to, well, what are you doing with it? Who are you spending it on? We don't believe in that. Shouldn't, et cetera.
Well, I think that the advocacy work is more, so we do go to like our senators. We actually, interestingly enough, Tim Kaine held a roundtable earlier this week for all the different groups that are involved in working with Afghans, just to kind of get a feel for what's going on. And we definitely reach out to at both the state and the federal level, just, and a lot of that is just encouraging, making sure that people know exactly like what you're saying, that they know why the money is important, how it's being used, how carefully it's being used, why it's so critical. So we work on that, and IRC would work in coalition with, there's kind of different coalition groups of refugee advocates who often work together in that way at, in Washington at that level.
Just 2 minutes left with Harry Kaur, International Rescue Committee in the Charlottesville office. Harriet, how has COVID has affected everything? How has it affected the IRC and refugee resettlement?
Yeah, we've changed how we do our work a lot. I mean, you know, what's going to be interesting is, you know, what's going to happen when this is, hopefully it'll be over someday. We are still, partially open, meaning we have staff working out of our office. We're still not really bringing clients into our office. We go out to them and try to see them where they are and outside as much as possible. But we're doing a lot of our services online. Our English classes are all on Zoom, still, things like that. So, we've really had to try, just like everyone else, new strategies. But we're kind of, what's interesting is, you know, a lot of our clients, some of them are extremely tech savvy, and some of them we're pulling them with us into the digital age, and really helping them develop those skills so they can kind of meet this new world that we're living in now. But we are still here, you know, and we're still serving, just in different, you know, kind of with some special adaptations.
And I'm under the impression that there are at least one or more families, Afghani families, in the area already. And let me rephrase that, because you said it's a large community. From this current catastrophe?
So we had about a dozen families come in right after, like late July. We had some families who were able to get on flights and get out, right before the airport shut down. They got out on their own. We had some people that came to us right off those very first flights that came into, you know, and came through Fort Lee. And then we haven't had anybody come in quite a while, but we are starting, our first, evacuee families are coming to us this week. So they're starting to come.
All right. Well, thank you for all your work. I'm sure it's, as you said, it's always a challenge. It always feels good, when things are successful. And, it's always a little sad to see why it has to happen.
Well put.
International Rescue Committee, Harriet Kaur. She's the executive director at the Charlottesville office. Rescue.org to see what's going on around the world. Thank you, Harriet. Take care.
Thank you, Rick.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.